against us, and it'll be a thing, right? Listen, we're jumping back into a series today that we're calling The Good Life. And I know there's a lot of debate, right, around what makes a good life even good. And the question that we've asked in this series is, what if the good life demands some difficult moments, some difficult times, some difficult seasons? And we've been looking at the life of a guy named Job and his story. And so when we started, we said that he was kind of this mixture. He was Elon Musk financially and Billy Graham spiritually. But inexplicably, what happens to Job in the first two chapters is that his family, his finances, his physical health are all just wiped out in one fell swoop. And really, the only question left is, will he also lose his faith? And that's really what the book is about. And so we started the first week by asking the why question, because when pain and suffering come into our lives, that's the first question that we ask, right? Is why? Why him? Why her? Why us? Why me? Why now? Why the Holocaust? Why infertility? Why cancer? Why loneliness? Like, those are the questions that we ask. And when we said eventually that the answer was, what we really need in those moments is to know that God loves us and that he's with us. And then the second week, we talked about the how question. How am I going to make it through this? And the answer was comfort. And God provides comfort a lot of times through the comfort of friends. And last week, Chad mentioned it. I talked about it in week number two. This whole idea of sitting Shiva, this Hebrew concept that when someone that you love, that you care about, loses someone that they love and that they care about, you would make this commitment to go sit with them, sit Shiva with them for 7 days. And some of you made comments to me like, Dean, I would have hated that. I would have hated that if I was on the suffering side, right, the sufferer side, or on the other side. I would have. But it was a reminder to me that we are not far. We're probably two, maybe three generations in our country from the tradition that was referred to as sitting up with the dead. I don't know how much you know about this. It's more Southern thing, Appalachian thing, where I grew up. But if someone who you love, someone from your home, passed away, there weren't funeral homes. And so a rudimentary mortician would come to your home, do the best they could to prepare the body that would stay in your home for the next 4 to 8 days while family and friends and relatives could get there for the ceremony. So that meant there was a corpse or a dead body in your home overnight. So someone was appointed to sit up with that individual. I found a picture. I'll show you up here. And one of the things that's interesting to me about this picture of a home, it's there. We're just making you wait. We're just making you anticipate, right, that it's coming. One of the things that you notice in homes where this happens, the thing at least that stands out to me, is all the flowers. The house is just packed with flowers. And I didn't realize that the reason that we send flowers to funerals actually came from this idea that they were there to cover up the smell, right? The decomposition, if you will, of a body that's sitting in your home. There's the picture. I saw the other. Who is in the black hood? I want to know who that is. I want to know why the dad has a tuxedo on. Is it a black tie funeral, right? And then that little guy in the front. Little Jeffrey Dahmer, just staring at you, right? I'm sure, just sure that's who that kid is, right? You know, we do kind of live these lives that are a little bit distilled, right? That are kind of a little more pure, maybe, if you will, and sterile and clean. And a couple of generations ago, life was a little more raw. And the book of Job is that way. It's just raw. It's emotion. And I think that's why it's so helpful to so many people, is that we get this look that we don't get anywhere else into the realities of pain and suffering and staying in relationship with God and wrestling that out. Matter of fact, Job chapter 3, right after all this happens at the beginning of the book, Job says this in verse 1 and then verse 8. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. Let those who curse it curse the day. Job says, listen, I want all the day cursers, which that's a weird occupation, right? Job says, I want all the day cursers to get together, and I want them to curse my birthday, which is another way of saying, what? I wish I was never born. The day that I was born must be cursed. That must be why all of this is happening to me. But there's a shift that takes place in the book. I'm going to say it's about 60%, about two-thirds of the way maybe through the book, where Job begins to see what is happening in his life from the perspective of wisdom. And if I'm going to define wisdom for us, I'm going to define it this way, that wisdom is seeing all of life like God does. Wisdom is this unique ability to have a perspective, and it's God's perspective on what's going on in our lives. And so what Job is going to do today is going to give us two things, really important things. Number one, he's going to tell us where to find wisdom. And number two, he's going to tell us why it matters so much. So we're going to look at Job chapter 28. So if you want to turn over there, if you have a copy of the scriptures, it says this, verse 12, but where can wisdom be found? He asks that where question. And where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its value, nor is it found in the land of the living. The deep says it's not in me, and the sea says it's not with me. Pure gold cannot be given in exchange for it, nor can silver be weighed, can be weighed as its price. Job says that wisdom is a treasure. It's like gold or silver that you drill for, right? You have to go get it. It's like it's in the depths of the sea. You have to go find it. You have to go get it because it's so very valuable for us. You're like, well, why is it so valuable? Well, when you think about it, I'm going to guess that 50% of the most significant decisions in your life are going to be determined by the rules. They're clear. The other 50% of the most significant decisions in your life are going to be determined by wisdom. You got to apply wisdom, right? Should I date this person or should I not date this person? Should I marry this person or should I marry someone else or not marry this individual, right? Should I take this job or that job? Should I move to this city or that city? Or should I move somewhere, you know, another country, another town, another whatever, far, far away? There are so many decisions in our lives and in our world that are just, that just can't be determined by the rules. There's no chapter and verse necessarily for that. But Job says, man, wisdom is there. It's available to us. So I'm going to say it to you this way. Wisdom rules where the rules fall short. Wisdom rules where the rules sometimes are going to fall short. And so Job falls into the category in the Bible of wisdom literature. There are other books that are in that category as well. I just want to say about wisdom literature, like, you have to know that wisdom literature is generally true across all times. It's poetic, it's rhyme, it's meter. And you think about poetry that way, right? That, hey, this is something that is generally true. It's artistic in the way that it's written. But you think about the book of Proverbs. Proverbs may be the most popular wisdom literature in the scriptures. And, you know, so Proverbs, in one place, it says things like, hey, if you work really hard, and you save your income, and you're generous with it, God will bless you, and you'll be wealthier at the end of your life than you are at the beginning of your life. That's generally true over the arc of your life. But Proverbs also says in other places, you can work really, really hard, and everything can fall apart. So which one is it, right? It's wisdom. It's generally true over time, but we all have acute moments. Maybe a financial crisis hits for some reason or another reason, right? That it's, you can't really put it in the perspective of rules. Like, it's always going to be this. It's always going to be this way. I've mentioned this to you before, that Proverbs chapter 26 and verse 4. Proverbs 26:4 says, do not answer a fool in his folly, or you will become like him. In other words, don't get involved in petty arguments with foolish people because you're going to end up looking like a fool. But literally the next verse, verse 5 of chapter 26 says, answer a fool in his folly, and you will save, right? You will save a brother, you will save a sister. So there is a moment where you're supposed to address a fool, and maybe that's going to help bring life change. And you're like, well, how do you know? How do you know when to speak up or keep your mouth shut? It takes wisdom. It takes spirit, presence of God actively at work in your life. So this really doesn't help Job a lot in terms of, where is it found? he actually answers his own question about 12 verses later. He'll ask it and then answer it. Verse 20, where then does wisdom come from? What's the source, in other words? And where is the place of understanding? And to a man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. If I could describe wisdom for you again, I would say that wisdom is applied reverence. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, but we can't leave off the end of it because it says, and to depart from evil is understanding. So you can't just say, well, I don't care at all about the rules because there are boundaries, there are things that are clear, and we want to avoid those things, right, as much as possible, as much as we can. Now, I know that a lot of us, when I say the fear of the Lord is wisdom, like that's where you find it. Wisdom comes from God. You're going to say, yeah, but Dean, I operate in an environment that basically the assumption is that if you're an intelligent human being, you don't even believe God exists. And that is problematic in the environment that you're in, but it doesn't have to be problematic for you. Job would say the reason that's problematic is because wisdom comes primarily through revelation. We get wisdom from God. It's applied reverence. Let's take those two words individually, right? Let's talk about reverence first. What does it mean to revere someone? Fear of the Lord means to revere. It means that I say about God, I am going to believe what God says and trust what God says more so than how I feel about what God says. It means that I'm trusting the reality that God created the world, and because it's his creation, not my creation, he knows better than I do how it works, and he knows more than I do about what his plan is for my creation. What is that? Why is that important? Because there's going to be times when you and I interact with the scriptures, and we're going to look at it, and we're going to go, you know, I don't really agree with that. That's okay. But the question is, who do you revere? Do you revere your own thoughts more, or do you revere God's thoughts more? That makes sense? So you may disagree with something that God says about family, or about marriage, or about dating, or about relationships, or about finances. You may disagree, and that's okay. As long as you say, you know what, God, you're smarter than me, so I'm going to trust what you say more than I trust my impulses, and more than I'm going to trust how I feel. That's reverence. And it's not just reverence. It's not just saying that I believe it, but that I'm going to apply it, that I'm going to trust it in the ways that I live and behave, in the ways that I carry out my life. And this has been true throughout church history. There have been these moments where applied reverence interacts with our lives, pain and suffering. I think about Thomas Aquinas, one of the greatest Christian philosophers, one of the greatest philosophers in world history. He lived in the 11th century. I'll throw a picture of Aquinas up here for you to see. I don't know what was going on with male hair trends in the 11th century, but Aquinas was rocking it, whatever that was. He was born in Sicily to a pretty wealthy family. There, he showed incredible theological acumen at a very, very young age. And he had an uncle who was the abbot of Monte Cassino. It was a position of enormous social prestige. And so everyone just kind of thought that as Thomas grew, that when his uncle retired, he would take that position. But as Thomas grew, especially during his teenage years, he didn't like what was going on there in Sicily. He didn't like the cocktail of power and spiritual stuff and religion and politics and money and sensuality. And so before his uncle could retire, he joined an upstart group called the Dominicans. And the Dominicans were a group, they were a group of younger leaders. They'd taken a vow of poverty, and so they were struggling all the time. They were hungry, trying to minister to people and reach people. And his family, Aquinas' family, lost their minds. So much so that mom and dad and the siblings found the Dominican group, and they snuck in one night, and they kidnapped Aquinas from the Dominicans and brought him back home, thinking they could talk some sense into him. They locked him up in a room at their house, presumably some sort of a castle-type room. They knew he was hungry, so they put all the creature comforts in there. Wine, cheese, meat. They thought, we'll break him. And Aquinas refused to eat. So the family's like, well, what are we going to do? We got to level up here. We got to do something else. So you know what they did? They went out and hired a high-end prostitute in Sicily. They brought her home, open the door, shove her in the room, lock the door back behind her, and they think this will do it. This will break him. 10 minutes later, she's banging on the door to get out. Because whenever she went into the room, when Aquinas realized that she had been set up and sent to seduce him, he went over to the fire and took the iron poker out of the fire, red hot, and chased her around the room with it to chase her to the door, right, to get her out of there. So throughout Christian history, this has been part of who we are, right? We're going to love God with everything we have, and we're going to depart from evil. We're going to get away. We're going to chase sin out of our lives at every opportunity, because we understand that the fear of the Lord is the beginning. It's the beginning of wisdom. And wisdom literature, it says it over and over and over again. Proverbs chapter 11, for example, verse 3, it says this, that the integrity of the upright guides them, but the crookedness of the treacherous destroys them. See, it's important that we all become good sin fighters, because there is crookedness in all of us. We're born flawed and broken into this world. We come into this world with a sin nature that we're turned towards ourselves. We're selfish, right? At the church that I was able to be an intern at whenever I was in seminary, and Angie was an intern there, it was called Bellevue in Memphis, and the pastor was a guy named Adrian Rogers. And whenever he would talk about Proverbs 11:3, that verse that we just read, he said, there is some good news. And the good news is that God strikes straight licks with crooked sticks, right? So that even though there is a flawed heart inside of us, even though there is brokenness inside of us, that God can redeem it through wisdom, through reverence, through trusting him. I think the struggle for us, as highlighted in the book of Job, is that we live between two worlds, really. The first world is what I'll call the ideal world, and that's the world where things, you know, things work as they ought to be. How things ought to work, how things ought to go. It's a world of formulas and inputs, and it's a world of reciprocation, right? It's a world where I do this, and therefore the output is this. I love somebody, and they reciprocate, and they love me back. Like, that's the ideal world, how things are supposed. It's a world of order. But then there's another world, the world that we all live in. It's not the ideal world. It's the real world, right? It's not a world of order. It's a world of chaos. It's not the world the way things ought to be. It's the world the way things really are. And I put in these inputs, and I try and do the right thing, but I don't always get paid back for the way that I love someone, but they don't reciprocate back to me the way that I would expect, whether that's in a friendship relationship or a work relationship or a romantic relationship. It doesn't work, and there's this struggle between the ideal and the real. Idealists tend to deny the chaos, and realists tend to deny the order. That's kind of how it works. And so you take somebody who says, you know what, I'm a good employee. I show up on time, I do my work, but I'm passed over time and time again for this promotion. So God must not exist. Or you take a spouse and they say, I'm a good spouse. I care about my husband, or I care about my wife. Why don't they reciprocate to my needs? God must not, he must not care. Or you take a single person who would like to be married, and they're like, listen, I'm watching my friends, and they're lining up at the altar again and again and again. And like, when is it going to be my chance? When is it going to be my time? I'm not even sure that God is around. Like, it feels like God is far away. I had this business partner that I trusted, and da-da-da-da-da, and just over and over and over again. It's this struggle between the ideal and the real. I don't think these are questions of God's existence at all. But they are representative of the struggle in these moments of pain and suffering, these seasons that come, these seasons of waiting and patience and desire, and in particular, unfulfilled desire. I think there's a great mirror to this verse in the New Testament. The church planter, the apostle writer, Paul, he writes to the Roman Christians in Romans chapter 12, verse 9, and he says this, love must be sincere. Hate what is evil and cling to what is good. I would summarize that verse this way. We love God and we fight sin. Like that's a good summary of what Paul is trying to get the Roman Christians to live towards. Because this is where the ideal and the real, right? This is where they come together for us. When we start to believe the things that God says about God and the things that God says about us. So what? So, you know, it's not that I'm loved by God because I obey. No, it's that I obey God because I am loved by God. It's not I'm accepted by God because I perform for God. No. It's that I perform. I want to please God in everything I do. I want to fight sin, right? I want to gain wisdom. I want to do that. I want to perform. I want to please God because I'm accepted by him. In spite of my crookedness, in spite of my sin, God can use my life. He can strike straight licks, right? And here's how this is helpful to us in moments of pain and suffering. Because there are two parts to a difficult moment, right, in our lives, to an event in our lives that hurts. One part of that is the actual pain of whatever happens, whatever the event is. That's one part. But I think I've found in a few decades of doing ministry that most people can make it through the event. It's not as much the event, it's the other part of it that we struggle with, which is the shock of the event. It's this idea that something like this could happen to someone like me. It's the shock of it. And from one pastor's perspective, the difference between a lot of people who grow through things and gain wisdom, and people who just go through things and endure, is that some people expect suffering to come. Some people understand because I live in a fallen world, there are going to be things, there are going to be moments, there are going to be times, and the shock doesn't rattle them as much. It just doesn't shake them up as much. And it doesn't mean we pretend like it doesn't hurt or that it doesn't exist. As a matter of fact, we're going to launch a brand new term of life groups next Sunday, and we've got a brand new group starting this, it's called Grief Share, for people who are walking through, because there's a process that you go through a lot of times when you've gone through something that's difficult or traumatic, or that you kind of have to grieve that we don't deny that, you have to grieve that out. But at the same time, sometimes our lives have gotten a little bit sterile and comfortable to the degree that it was just, how could that happen? I'll give you two examples, one that's personal and then one from someone who's been through much more than I've ever gone through in my life. But for me, I'll say I remember one of my earliest memories as a child was getting my DTaP vaccination, right? DTaP, right? Diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, right? And I'm going to guess I was 4 years old, 5 years old, something like that. I remember my mom taking me to Dr. Folsom's office, right, and understanding and knowing that there was a shot that was coming. And so there were two parts to that. And one part was the pinch of the needle that I'm sure was, you know, so long, I mean, in the syringe, right? It was horrible. So there was that part of it. But the other part was the shock that my mom would just stand in the room while this misdemeanor crime and felony was occurring, right? That she did nothing to stop the criminals, the perpetrators of what was happening. Like there were two parts to that. But then, you know, God blessed me with children. Try explaining shots to children, vaccinations to children. Like there's no way you think, well, here's what I'm going to do. This was my idea. I thought I'm going to tell them a couple of weeks ahead. That way they can prepare. Long-term dread every day. Like, when is the doctor? When do we have to go to the doctor? When do we have to, right? So then, well, we're going to flip it. We're going to go the other way. We're just going to go to Kroger, and we're going to stop by the doctor's office on the way home, right? And then it's sheer panic. One of my children, which shall remain nameless for the purposes of this story, went in for a vaccination, and that child and Angie, they were going from the waiting room to the examination room, right? Walking down the hall, and Angie just started up a conversation with the nurse, and they went to turn in the room, and the child was gone. Back down the hallway, back to the waiting room, headed towards, right, towards the car. Like, we're not doing this, right? So part of it is that, right? It's the pain or the pinch of what happens, but then it's the shock. And if you could imagine the shock that Job had with no explanation, imagine your bank account being wiped out. Imagine losing all of your children, if you have children, or family members that are significant to you. Imagine being covered head to toe with painful sores all in one fell swoop. And so we get the shock, right? I want the day cursers. Curse my day. But then something starts to shift in the book. And you start to get a glimmer of the person that Job is becoming. You start to realize that God is turning Job into gold. Chapter 13, verse 15, just listen to what Job says. Though he slay me, though he, God, slay me, yet will I trust him. It's amazing what can grow in the human soul if we're willing to revere, if we're willing to love God and fight sin. I said, I'll give you another example from someone who's been through so much more than I've been through. There's a fantastic Christian author that I would recommend to you. Her name is Elizabeth Elliot. She was twice widowed before she was 35 years old. One of those husbands died tragically in service as a missionary. But Elliot writes in one of her books that when she was a teenage girl, 13, 14 years old, that she spent a summer in the highlands of Wales, where her uncle was a sheep farmer, and that during the summers, there was a particular insect, a weevil, that would bore into the heads of the sheep and lay an egg, a parasite that would kill the sheep. And so the only way that the sheep could fend that off was that all of them had to be dunked in a vat of antiseptic, a barrel of antiseptic. And so she would watch with her uncle as he would grab them hooves and hooves, and sometimes two men would have to wrestle them, and they would get them over this really big barrel, and they would just plunge them under and hold them, and the sheep is bawling, and its hooves are pounding against the sides of the barrel. And Elliot, she said, I would cry tears, right, as they're not only just plunged under, they have to be held there underneath that antiseptic until it really soaked in. And she said, I went to my uncle and I said, isn't there something you can do? Can't you explain it to them? In her empathy and sympathy, can't you sit down and explain it to them? Like, what's occurring? And her uncle, of course, you know, being a shepherd for many years, he's like, well, sure, go ahead. You explain it to them, what's about to happen, and we'll see if that makes it better. And after that experience, and after, like I said, twice widowed before she was 35 years old, thinking and reflecting back on that experience, she writes this short, brief statement. Then I understood why the great shepherd held me underneath. Isn't that fantastic? That a human being can revere God to the degree that wisdom starts to grow in the human soul, to the degree that you begin to see things the way that God sees things, and you begin to understand that in the most difficult moments of your life, that he's turning you into gold. He's refining you into something beautiful and something useful. He's chipping away everything in your heart and your soul that doesn't look like Christ to bring you out to the image. And you're like, Dean, that sounds great. I mean, it all works in the explanation, but I just don't see it. And I would agree. If that's all we had, if we had the book of Job, if we had Proverbs, and that's all we had, I could agree. But we have more. This is why whenever Paul writes to the Corinthians, that he starts this first letter to them off in chapter 1 with a statement like this in verse 18. He says, "For the word of the cross is folly, foolishness, to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God." If all we had was human explanation, if all we had were blocks that we tried to fit together into some puzzle of reason, I could agree, but we have so much more than that, because what we have is a Savior, right, who left the ideal. Everything in heaven is, it's the world as it ought to be. It is a world of perfection and order, and we have the only God who left that world and came down here to the real. He came down to walk it out beside of us. The scriptures say that he was tested in every way, just like you and I are, that he walked through suffering. So we have a God, this is the uniqueness, that can say alongside of you, when you say, "God, I don't get it, this hurts," he can say, "I know. I have been there. I have walked that road. I understand." To the point that at the end of his life, Paul says, "Listen, I know you think the word of the cross, it's foolishness, unless you understand who you are, unless you understand the world, that you're in this tug of war between the ideal and the real, unless you understand that there's no way that you can solve the crookedness in your own soul." So what? So Jesus, the foolishness that a God would leave the ideal and come to the real and live in the chaos and go to the cross, this is where it all makes sense. That's what Paul's saying. That it's not just that he would suffer alongside of us, but that he would suffer for us. That his Father, in sending him to the cross, would hold him underneath. Underneath the condemnation of being numbered with common criminals. Underneath a crown of thorns. Underneath the weight and the pressure of sin and the guilt and the shame of your sin, my sin, that all comes with it. The scriptures say in Isaiah that it pleased the Lord to crush him. Why? That sounds so violent. So that he could bring us back to God. That he wasn't just crushing his son. He was saving us. He takes the vaccination. He takes the needle. We get the immunity. He's held under. We get the antiseptic. We get life in the place of death. And because that transaction takes place, it grows love in us. So we love God, which means that we become really, really good sin fighters. And listen, that's why moments like this are so important. That's why it's so important to gather corporately on a Sunday, to gather in a life group, to be reminded of what we have in the person of Christ. I thought about this this morning. That by the time we get here at 11 o'clock, already keep going east and east and east. Go to the far, far east. Already this morning, believers in China have gathered, some in very small communities, in the dark, behind closed doors, and they sing songs in a whisper because they fear that if they're discovered, they'll be persecuted and lose their lives, but they can't not do it. It is life to them. And if you keep moving this direction, if you keep moving west, already today across the continent of Africa, people have sang loudly with their voices. They've danced unashamedly in front of God in worship. And so what we do this morning is we're reminded that all over the world are there people who, like us, are going through things, absolutely, but who are also worshiping, absolutely. And then I thought, Well, the reality is we're not just gathering up our worship around the world on a Sunday. But the reality is we're joining a much, much, much bigger choir. Revelation chapter 5 describes a picture where gathered around the throne of God, every tribe, every nation, every tongue, people are singing the praises of God. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain. The one who was, the one who is, the one who is to come. Holy, holy, holy is his name. That's why moments like this are so important this morning. Because as we gather, we don't just sing, but we worship through song and we revere through song. And as we do that, we're reminded of our need to trust the one who took our place. So let's do that. Right now, I'm going to pray for us, and then we're going to worship together. Lord, we bring our lives in front of you. We lay them down in front of you. God, I think about people in our church this week, this month, who are going through diagnoses and surgeries and house fires and incredible, incredible loss. And yet, God, we believe, as much as human beings can believe, we believe in faith that you are here, that you are with us. And the people, God, right now who are in this room, people who are listening online right now, going through things, that you are with them. As we just continue to stay in that attitude of prayer, I just thought maybe this morning you would say, that's me. I'm in a moment. I'm in a season. I want to be included in this. In this prayer. So maybe you just raise your hand right where you are. People aren't looking around. People don't know. It's just say, yep, I'm me. I'm in a moment. I'm in a season. Yeah, just put them up, take them right back down all over the room. Say, yeah, this is a moment. This is a season for me. The presence of God, the nearness of God, it's to my good. And Dean, I just want to declare trust. God, we lay our lives in front of you. We come together to worship you. We say, worthy is the Lamb who was slain. It's in your name we pray. Amen.